This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. You're tuned into the evening edition. Caroline and Uma with you. Now, it's unfortunate that we're all too familiar with news about poaching, wildlife trafficking, and wildlife species losing their habitats due to deforestation and pollution. But are we becoming desensitized to information about threats to the wildlife? How much does the general public care about biodiversity? How much do they actually know about it? And today we're going to talk about educating communities on wildlife conservation. Joining us today, we have Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces, Associate Professor on Ecology and Biodiversity Conservation at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus, as well as John Mathay, Chief Operating Officer of Rimba Research. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty, I think it's important that we find out how the both of you got into what you do. So tell us your stories. How did you get interested in wildlife conservation? Was it something you were always keen on from a young age?
Yes and no. So then I guess like many people in this field, I got into this by being outdoors. So then I always went camping. My family always liked to go camping since I was... In my early teens, I would go with my friends for snorkeling, for spending weekends outdoors. So then I developed some kind of interest in nature and being outside. And then once I was studying, I studied biology. And when I joined university, I was more thinking on the lines of microbiology, cell biology. And then I realized that I could make a career out of being outdoors, which it hadn't come across as a real possibility. I thought... was more like a National Geographic kind of thing, you know, like these people from very far away can do these things, but it's not something I could choose to do.
Yeah.
But then I found that actually there was a need to do good science, to do conservation, and then by the time I realized I was living in Asia, studying elephants in Sri Lanka and having an exciting life that I was not expecting. And yeah, very, very happy to have chosen this career path.
Very John, nice. What about you?
Yeah. Me, definitely not. I grew up never studying biology before. I was focusing mainly on maths, physics. My first degree was civil engineering. First master's was environmental engineering. I worked as an environmental engineer for a while. And then, yeah, somewhere along the way, I guess disillusionment, frustration with the whole engineering thing set in. Took some time off. Just to find myself, I guess. And then with absolutely no background in biology, absolutely no background in ecology, absolutely no background in fieldwork, the only reason I used to go to the jungle when I was an engineer was to get drunk. That was it.
It's a fantastic motivation.
So yeah, I just made a complete switch. I just felt that I needed to do this.
I suppose both of you would be at a stage where you've been in it for a while now. Obviously, you know your field. What do you think people are missing out on when they don't know about the environment, when they don't know about the kind of work that you do?
So I think one thing is people don't really understand, first of all, or have this wrong idea of what conservation is. I think there are still a lot of people who think that petting or stroking cuddly animals is conservation.
You mean it's not?
So people have this weird idea of what conservation is. For me personally, it's learning how to live in balance, in harmony with all of nature, allowing the rivers, the soil, the air, biodiversity to play their ecological roles. Because we all need each other to function. We're all connected. And allowing that to take place in the best possible manner is what conservation is all about. And we all need to be involved in it because we all drink the water. We all breathe the air. So we are all responsible to take care of the environment. This is not the purview, the responsibility of scientists or conservation scientists or tree huggers or conservationists. No. All of us have to do this, and I think this hasn't sunk into most people yet. They think, oh, this is not my problem. Yeah, I think that's the biggest issue.
Well, I think we live in a unique time in history. It never has happened before that we have the environmental issues and problems that we have at the scale we have right now. So then until very recently, until 100, 200 years ago, human societies live at a small scale, there were small communities, they might overuse resources locally, but it never happened at a global scale. So we have moved now in a situation in which we have over 7 billion people in the planet. Again, never happened before. Just think about when my grandma was born, there were 2 billion people in the planet. But now they are almost four times as much. You know, yeah. There is no other species that has ever grown at this scale. And we influence the planet in a way never happened before. So then we are not hardwired to understand the implications of this. We have serious difficulties to understand the consequences of the way we are affecting the planet, biodiversity, climate change, all these kind of things. So then I think it's, to some extent, it's understandable that people have difficulties grasping this. Also, think that the conservation as an idea, as a discipline, if you want, is very new. It was formed in the 80s. The concept has been there forever, right? Sustainability, living in harmony. Many traditional societies have been doing this for millennia. But in the way that we understand modern conservation, it just appeared in the 80s. But think about Malaysia as an example of how back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, all the policy, all the education was about economic development. We told people what you need to do is to develop economically. And then suddenly in the last 10, 15 years, we're telling people, hey, it's a very sudden change and mindsets take time to change. We need to really understand why it will take some time for people to get the big picture and why we need to act now. So then the change happens at the right scale, you know, as soon as possible.
And you know, I was watching that documentary on National Geographic Channel with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was that interesting scene where he was speaking to someone in India.
Yeah.
And they went back to that argument of, oh, you know, it's all well and good for America and Europe to tell us this. Because they've already reached a certain level of economic development. Mm-hmm. But you're going to hold us back because we have mouths to feed.
Yeah.
That's a very tricky argument, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's and I understand why people make that argument. They need to be very sensitive to that argument, but it's a fallacy. And I don't think people are using this fallacy intentionally. I mean, these people in developing countries, but it's like the mobile phone. Okay, in the U.S. or in Europe, people had fixed lines for many years. There was a telegraph, there was a fixed phone, and then the mobile phone revolution came 20 years ago, and then now everyone has a mobile phone. But if you go now to Malawi or to Sudan, people have mobile phones. We're not asking them to go through the process of setting the telegram and the fixed line. We say, okay, what do we need now in the current context, and what are the solution we have for now? So I think what we need to understand is that the impact that the developed countries, industrialized countries, had on the environment in that historical context, you know, there was not awareness of what were the implications. Nowadays, we cannot afford to do the same. And there are some economic theories that imply that you need to pollute first before becoming clean. But that's not true. That, again, is looking at the past, not looking at the future. And we don't understand that we need to look at what kind of development models we want to have. So then we need to be sensitive to inequality, to unfair, historical unfair situations, but we don't need to repeat the same errors. We need to say, okay, what kind of future do we want? How we can achieve economic well-being and, you know, people's well-being without compromising this bigger picture things.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess it all begins with education. Even for you, like you said a little earlier, the only time you realized that you could have a career out of it was when you were much older. What's the best way to excite, say, children in school? I mean, you think of a syllabus that we have here. There really isn't much by way of appreciating a larger picture when it comes to environment. And, you know, like you said, you know, we're all a part of it, but you somehow feel removed, especially when it comes to education. What's the best way to do that, you think?
I think kids have to spend more time outdoors rather than just sitting in front of their... I don't know what kids now do with their cell phones and all that. But they should go outdoors more and experience actually the connection, the oneness of all life. I mean, from what I understand, from what I see, also a lot of scientists like to study ecosystems, like to study animals. And then they will write papers about it, and they will publish, and they will go to conferences and talk about it. But that doesn't necessarily translate into a change in their behavior or their way of life. They don't experience it as truth.
It doesn't translate to action on the ground, exactly. And also doesn't translate to, I suppose, kids in the next generation, exactly. And the likes.
So kids need to spend more time observing life, being excited by it. What got me into this was just sitting in nature for long periods of time and just feeling that oneness.
It sounds so zen.
In a way it is, because when it zapped me that... So a lot of people look for problems out there to fix. I have to fix this, I have to fix that. It hit me that there really isn't anything out there to fix. I need to fix myself first. Right. I am the problem. And that actually gave me a huge sense of empowerment, because if I am the problem, I am the solution.
Yeah.
I can either choose to remain the problem or I can evolve into the solution. It's just each and every one of my actions. And I have a choice. In every one of my actions, I have a choice. I can either continue doing what everyone else does and remain the problem, or try to do things in a different way and be part of the solution. Yeah.
We're speaking today with John Masai from Rimba Research, as well as Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arses from the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. And in a bit, we're going to be talking about zoos. Are they good or bad? More after this. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
This is the Evening Edition. You're on with Caroline and Uma, and today we're talking about educating communities on wildlife conservation. Our guests are John Masai, COO of Rimba Research, as well as Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arses, Associate Professor at the University of Nottingham Malaysia Campus, and Principal Investigator of MEME, the Management and Ecology of Malaysian Elephants.
I'm just wondering whether or not the same applies to kids, or, you know, of school-going age, whether everybody gets that epiphany the more time you spend outdoors.
Well, it's becoming harder and harder, right, to get children outdoors.
No.
Is it not?
Let me bring some optimism here. So then, I think we're having two parallel discussions here. One is the idea of education and children, and the one is the idea of the role of people in the environmental crisis, right? Mm-hmm. So then, I 100% agree that... people are the problem, maybe people are the solution. So then we need to empower people to become the solution. Mm-hmm. And then it's our job, you know, people like us, you, the media, and John and I, who are professionals on conservation, to really create mechanisms so people can do the right thing. And when it comes to education, I think it's very important the link between knowledge, familiarity, awareness, so knowing something, and that creates a sense of care, and then that can change behavior. So I think these three steps, you know, awareness, care, behavioral change, they are related. It's not always straightforward. there can be some barriers in between, but it's a really, they're linked steps. So, and I think for children, we don't want children to solve the problem. We want to be empowered to solve the problem in the future. So then we need to start by creating familiarity, awareness, education, exposure, and this can be information itself, but also has to be experiential. People need to spend time in nature. And then, I don't know, I teach tropical ecology, and I take many students to the forest, many mm-hmm. Malaysian students, mm-hmm. and you will be surprised how many students come, and they always tell me every year, I didn't know that the forest is so cool. You know, I am a Malaysian. I've never been in the forest. People in the early 20s, I had never been in the forest like this. And this is a life-changing experience. So then that for me is one of the most rewarding part of my job. It's like, I cannot believe that you had the forest, because Kuala Lumpur is full of forest. You can go hiking anywhere. And people just haven't done it. Yeah. But things are changing. If you hiking in Kuala Lumpur any Saturday, any Sunday, you will see many people that 10 years ago were not there. So the reason why I want to bring the optimism is, I think, because Malaysia has gone through some kind of demographic change in which now it's a urban society. People live in cities. But those cities are still close to forests. So compared with other cities in the region, in the world, in Malaysia it's very easy to have a walk in Ampang or in Bukit Cheras or not in Bukit Saga or in Bukit Telur, and then experience the forest within 20 minutes from your condominium or from your home. And if we create more opportunities for people to understand that this is there, go there, use it, they will care for it. And then if they care for it, hopefully they put more value, and then they will do things that are compatible with conservation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, absolutely right in that it doesn't feel as though we appreciate it, right? We don't talk about, you know, you're like, Uma, what are you doing this weekend? I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going to do this. Yeah, it's never, I'm going to go hiking down the road.
Yeah, if I can comment, we did a study last year identifying the conservation priorities in Peninsula Malaysia that was led by Ken Agulendran, one of my students. And one of the key priorities in Malaysia was connecting people to nature. So basically, people who participate in that process agree that Malaysians don't seem to value biodiversity, even though Malaysia is one of the most biodiversity-rich countries in the world.
Yes.
People like me work in this country because it's exciting. I'm so excited when I work, you know, when I think about the forest here. But people don't know about that. But I think it's not too difficult to expose people to this excitement. You just need to take them to the forest and then, you know, have some experience that changes things.
What about zoos? They get such a bad rap. And, you know, I've made a conscious decision not to go to zoos because of all of the stuff that I've heard about it. Talk to us about zoos and animal sanctuaries. Are any good?
This is very close to my heart. I'm very in favor of zoos. I used to not be. So then around 15...
Convince me.
Yeah, okay. So around 15, 20 years ago, I didn't like the concept of animals in captivity, and I thought it was inappropriate. And there was a period of my life in which I didn't go to these kind of places. I went as a child, and now I go. Actually, I work actively with zoos. But then I did an experiment in the early 2000s in Ueno Zoo in Tokyo, in which I needed, as part of my research, I needed to have access to animals. And then I began to work. I began to spend time in the zoo, and I began to experience what the zoos can do. Let me give you an anecdote. We did a study last year trying to see how much people know about conservation in Malaysia. And I included one photo of one animal called okapi. Do you know what is an okapi?
No, I don't.
A deer kind of thing.
No, it's like a giraffe, but lives in the forest in Africa. So then only one person out of 600 knew what an okapi is.
One out of 600?
Yeah, in Kuala Lumpur, okay?
Right.
But something that I was always very impressed in Tokyo is that children, 6-7-year-old kids, they know what is an okapi, they know what is a tapir. So, well, how these kids know what is an okapi? And it's because every spring they go to the zoo and they see a tapir and they see an okapi. So then I realized that there was a function there that was beyond. So then what we need to do is to have good zoos and close the bad ones. And we cannot have 20 zoos in a country like Malaysia. We need to have a few of them, 2-3 good ones, well-funded, well-designed, well-managed.
And you're right. When a child connects with an animal at that age, it creates an automatic emotional link. If I've never seen a tiger in real life or a hippopotamus or an elephant, when I read about it in the newspapers that there was ivory smuggling, it's not going to affect me emotionally. But when I've seen an animal, when I've touched an elephant, then I'll be like, oh, that's horrible, right? And I think that's true for a lot of things. And you're right. I can see how that connection is important.
So I'm in my 40s. Every time I see an elephant in captivity, I still feel something special. So I think we need to create opportunities to have this emotional attachment in a positive way. And I think, just to finish on the zoos, good zoos need to play four roles, okay? They need to be inspiring. We're talking about inspiration before. Again, it's very inspiring to see an elephant, a real elephant. But it has to be in a healthy, socially, you know, elephant social proper condition. Second, has to play a role for education. So then it's not only about the emotion, but also the information. The zoos can, you know, many people pass through a zoo every year. If you convey the right information, you get people who are in the right state of mind to absorb that information. They need to help conservation. So zoos play an important role nowadays, both in situ and ex situ. So zoos have to spend, like Copenhagen Zoo, spend 7% of the budget in ex situ conservation programs. We need all the zoos to say, it's not only about making money. I want you to spend 10% of your money in conserving tigers in the wild. And finally, they need to do research. So there are things that you need to have access to wildlife, and it's an opportunity there. So then, if zoos do these four things, I think we need to embrace them and we need to support them. And those who cannot fulfill these requirements,
Actually, I suppose just in observing our zoos over the years, have you seen improvements? Have you seen progress? Any optimism there?
I visited only very few zoos in Malaysia because I have the same problem as you. I don't really like to go to zoos. I don't like seeing animals imprisoned in captivity like this. I mean, I recognize, like Ahimsa was saying, that they're good zoos serve a very good function, but maybe my bad luck, I haven't really seen any good zoos, not in this country at least. So yeah, I haven't really, I can't really comment on that.
Yeah, sense. I mean, we like to use the Singapore Zoo as a comparison or as an example.
That's a good
example. It's so fun. You know, you do really feel as though you're up close with the animals, and I feel as though you have that connection. But have you observed our zoos here, and have you seen any improvements?
I don't have much experience in Malaysia. I heard about some. I heard that Taipin Zoo is the best zoo here. I haven't been there. Definitely, the zoos that I have seen in Malaysia, they are not great. So then, none of one reached the point that I'm talking about. So I think Singapore Zoo is the only one in Southeast Asia that's at that stage. But again, it's like conservation we were talking before. These things, until 20 years ago, the zoos were just about making money and having animals that don't die in prison, right?
So yeah.
But this has changed. So then now we have many conservation programs. Zoos are keeping whole populations of frogs that they don't exist in the wild anymore, for example. They are playing a big role in the captivity, in the captive breeding of rhinos, of Indian rhinos, for example. So then we need to really tell to the zoos, we want you to do a good job. And we understand that probably they cannot be run only as business. They probably need public funding, because if the zoo has to be profitable, then they're going to cut corners. And what we want to do is, okay, if we want them to play a social function, we need to support.
They have an important role to play.
We're speaking now with Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces from the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus, as well as John Mathai from Rimba Research. After the news, can we convince everyone to go vegetarian for the sake of biodiversity and the environment? Stay tuned and find out only on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition, Caroline and Uma with you. And on the show today, we've been thinking about ways to educate people about conservation so that knowledge actually translates into a way of life that's biodiversity friendly. Our guests today are Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces, Associate Professor of Ecology and Biodiversity Conservation at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus, as well as John Mathai, COO of Rimba Research. Let's talk about grown-ups. So we've talked about kids and, I guess, schools and zoos, but getting grown-ups on board is also a big part of the challenge. So, John, talk to us about engaging stakeholders that can somehow educate adults as well. Because as far as I know, when it comes to adults, yeah, we know Earth Hour, turn off the lights.
Is it too late to get Uma excited about the environment? I think that's the question we're going for.
I think, yeah, I mean, so like I said before, I think the main way is to get people to go out, to experience nature, to really understand that this is important. We need to maintain, we need to take care of what sustains us. And when you think about it, what is it that sustains us? What is it that allows us to live on this planet? It is the soil, it is the earth, it is the rivers, it is the climate, it is biodiversity, it is ecological processes. This is what allows us to live on this planet. If we don't take care of it, how on earth are we going to live on this planet? We have to realize how important that is.
And I think in many ways, sometimes that argument is put forward incorrectly, right? We say, hey, save the planet. Actually, the planet...
The planet is fine. George Carlin said that.
Correct.
The planet is fine. The people are...
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. We need to save ourselves.
Yes.
Because if we're not careful, we're the ones going to get wiped
exactly.
out.
Exactly. People just don't seem to... They are so short-sighted. I mean...
But we need to be realistic that, you know, our brain is wired to work as a temporal and spatial scale that is much smaller, okay? So then many of the environmental problems will affect maybe in 50, 80 years, which people have difficulty to visualize. So we need to make things in a way that, we need to bring the problem in a way that people can understand better, and we need to make this more real.
Yeah, no, how do you make it? How do you make it relatable, though?
Can I say something? Like, the previous models, okay, like when you were saying something about, who was it? Someone went to a farmer in India and said something. Who was it?
That's right. They were talking to a politician activist in India.
Well, the thing is, in the West, the model of development is not logical at all. It is what? Infinite growth based on finite resources.
Correct.
Now, that is completely insane. Can people not understand that? Just following that model, just because it has been applied, it doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. Why are we still following this model that doesn't make any sense?
But I think therein lies the point. I don't think that people can't understand. I think people perhaps may understand the urgency, but what do you do about it? So as a person on the street, how do you get excited about it to the point where it translates into something that you can do something about?
Well, we can do so many things about it.
For sure.
Like I said, once you realize you are the problem, you realize that every single one of your actions, you can either do this or you can do that. There is no one way of doing everything. You have choices. Make the correct choices.
So, with that in mind then, I think, Ahimsa, have you found that when people are presented with the choices, do they make the right choice, or are we by nature selfish individuals and just make the easy choice?
No, I would not portray as selfishness. I think it's more lack of awareness than being greedy. I think we have structural problems. Our whole economic system, it is based on growth. All our parameters, you know, countries like Japan, for example. Japan is a rich country. Everyone is middle class, which means being rich. But they are so concerned because they don't grow. Like, well, you know, but you are doing fine. You have everything you need. What is, because all the parameters by which we evaluate success at all scales, at country level, at company level, even at individual level, have to do with growth. Until we don't change these parameters, but besides the individual change, we need to have a structural change. We need to demand our policymakers, our politicians, our leaders say, okay, we want to have a different kind of economy and society because it is not sustainable. And even though everyone understands everyone understands the point, how to make that difference? You feel disempowered because, again, politicians it's are elected.
And also it feels like such a big problem that it's overwhelming.
Yeah. But it's our time. We need to do it. So then we are, as I said at the beginning, we are in an unprecedented time in history. So then our grandparents, their life was not very different to their parents or the offspring. But our life, we are in a unique time in the 21st century in which we need to change things big time or pay a very high cost. But also individuals have to understand there are changes that are within our hands, you know, what we eat, what we consume, how we move around. All these things are doable. But again, we need to make things easy for people. You know, if you use public transport in KL, it is doable nowadays, but still it's quite difficult.
It's not easy.
Let's make it easy for people. If you want to eat vegetarian, let's make it easy in the supermarket. If you want to buy things that are sustainable, let's make it clear so people can go, often I go to buy things. I have no idea if I'm doing the right choice or not. I'm willing to do it. I face options in the supermarket. I don't know which one should I buy. How can I know that which is the right one? So let's make things easy so people can do better choices.
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay, so I'll be honest. Speaking from my own personal experience, I have a limited understanding, I guess, of conservation and what to do to be good to the environment, right? And if I'm presented with two options, and if I know, and if they tell me this one is better for the environment, unless it's significantly more expensive, I will do it.
Yeah.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Shoot.
If I put forward the suggestion to you, are you vegetarian, by the way?
I was. Not anymore.
Okay, if I tell you that the meat industry is causing so much environmental damage, it is one of the contributors of practically everything, deforestation, biodiversity loss, obesity, diabetes, air pollution, water pollution, climate change even. So all these things, the meat industry is one of the main contributors, not to mention the cruelty, extreme suffering that factory farms are having. So why do people who claim to care about the environment, who claim to care about animal welfare, still participate in this industry?
Actually, I know the answer to that.
I was going to say I would still eat meat, but I would ask you why that's the case, because I don't know enough. So I guess any man on the street would probably be asking why. It's not immediate. I'm not going to stop eating meat today. It's a horrible thing. I mean, those are horrible things to know, but you know, I'm going to have a steak later.
But you need more information, right? I mean, no, I think the reason why is because
the information is out there.
No, but when we buy our meat, we still think of it as something that comes in a little plastic package. I mean, that's the problem, right?
Is that what it is?
No, it is. Because is that really? I have friends who have become vegetarian after being a lifetime of meat eaters when they visited a slaughterhouse. And it scarred them to such an extreme because they actually experienced it firsthand that they went, no. And I think we don't realize where our meat comes from. We think it's from the supermarket.
We want to engage people. So I think what we shouldn't do is blame people for doing things, which is the norm, okay? So when you are acting according to the norm, and we know that humans can do very bad choices when the environment is conducive to that. So then I think what we need to do is to create an environment to give people make better choices and be aware of the consequences of the choices. And so then that people know what is good and what is bad, and doing good is much easier than doing bad, and doing good is rewarded and doing bad is penalized. I admit, I grew up as a vegetarian, I spent half of my life as a vegetarian, now I eat meat and people are horrified. And it's like, I eat a small amount of meat, I would say I'm a low meat diet consumer, so then I don't buy meat at home, I don't cook meat at home. But I'm in a restaurant, something was come with meat, I eat it. And I don't make a big deal. But I know that my weekly meat consumption is a small amount. So something you can do, for example, without making a big lifestyle change that for some people might feel uncomfortable. Okay, so then I never eat meat at home, for example, because I never did that since I was a child. But I think it's fine to find positions in which you are not dividing between good doers and bad doers, because that creates a dichotomy. And do they engage people? Do you want to bring more people to do the good things? Mm. And I think the meat is a very good example. It's the most important thing we can do to contribute to the environment as individuals is our diet choices. That is what one individual can do most influence. But also we need to know, it's so confusing, oil palm, soya. Mm. So you replace meat with soya, and then where is your soya coming from? Mm. And it becomes overwhelming. Yeah. And then individuals kind of step back and say, I don't know what I'm
and
doing.
And then you go into denial.
I'm going to stop caring. Because, say, make your mind, you ask others to solve the problem so that you can make right choices. Yeah. So I think we need to really change the whole process. And also humans naturally like meat. I mean, we are omnivorous. Even we are mainly plant eaters, a bit of meat, it feels good. So then maybe we can find a kind of a point in which people have diets that are sustainable and that are not, don't have the high cost that nowadays have, which is awful. You know what's happening now with the meat production is really, really a very, very unnecessary environmental cost.
But can I just say one small
thing? Shoot.
So I'm just the opposite of you. I was a meat eater for so many decades of my life, and then I educated myself. I read papers, I went onto YouTube, I saw videos, and then I thought, okay, the information is out there and I really care about these issues. So I took the initiative to educate myself because the information is there. It's not like hidden in some obscure place and all. It's there. It's out there. If you care, you can go and find out. And so once I found out, I thought, no, I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. And I'm a much happier individual now. I'm not saying people should stop completely, but once you get the information, can you not reduce and slowly wean off it if that's possible?
I predict that if we do a good job, in 20 years' time, most people will be either vegetarian or almost vegetarian.
Really?
So then, I think so. I think it's the only thing that makes sense. But we need to do it in a way that the information is there, that making the right choices is yesterday I was having lunch with colleagues, and two of them are vegetarian. They could only have the mushroom soup. There was no other dish in the menu that was vegetarian.
Yeah.
So then that's a problem. And then most of us in that table, even those who are not strict vegetarian, will probably choose a vegetarian dish, and there was no option. So then we need to change those things and demand those changes and really think about how to get people into the right thing. But what you don't want to do is make a crusade of everything. You want to live a life that's not about fighting rightfulness and wrongfulness. So we need to make things that is normal for people to have options when you go to the supermarket, when you go to the restaurant, to do the right thing, and it's just normal. It's not a big deal. It's not, because people have many things that they want to invest their attention and energy on.
We're speaking today with John Mathai from Rimba Research, as well as Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces from the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. In a bit, we'll be talking about engaging Orang Asli communities in conservation efforts. Stay tuned. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
This is the Evening Edition with Caroline and Uma. We're speaking today with Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces, Associate Professor at the University of Nottingham Malaysia Campus, as well as John Mathai, COO of Rimba Research. And we've been thinking about ways to educate communities to make choices that support conservation efforts.
Now, just back to the education aspect for a little bit. So we've been talking about children, we talked about adults, all of that, different communities as well. So I guess in a lot of your conservation work, there are a lot of, I guess for us, it would be Orang Asli communities that live in the forest, live off the land. Is the assumption, though, for, I guess, a lot of urban people, is that conservationists and the Orang Asli groups would naturally work hand in hand? Is that necessarily the case? So in speaking with some anthropologists, for example, they don't always agree with that.
I would say mainly yes. I think there are a number of stereotypes about some kind of conservation conflict in which some people, particularly anthropologists, kind of perceive a conflict between conservation and indigenous communities. I think that's a completely misconception of framing. I think we are both on the same side. In both cases, nature and these communities are victim of development. Okay, so then they are suffering the same problem. So then because they are, then there's, you know, there's some amount of competition, but it's not because it's not that the wildlife are against people or people, or, you know, or actually against wildlife. It's that they are both victim of deforestation and a number of pressures. So we need to change the frame. I'm always very keen on saying, hey guys, Orang Asli and tigers are victims of this current economy and development model. So then we need to change the narrative and understand that yes, tigers can produce problem to Orang Asli, and Orang Asli can produce problem to tigers. But let's find solutions that are compatible for both of them.
So I worked with the Penan for many, many years. So I'm Sarawakian. I worked with the Penan for many years there. And I think a lot of people approach the indigenous people in a condescending way, as if, okay, you are part of the problem. We have to realize that they have been here much longer than us, and they did a very good job of living in harmony with nature. Mm. It's just that now with the pressures of development, their lifestyle have changed. But we should always look at them as... we have a lot to learn from them. They have a lot of traditional knowledge, especially in terms of medicinal plants. And they know a lot about the animals because they actually live with the animals. It's contextual knowledge, what they have. They, if you're not a good hunter, if you're not a good tracker, you can't eat. It's that simple out in Sarawak. So we can learn a lot from them rather than imposing our ideas on them. We can learn a lot from them. We should make them part of the solution. We should empower them to monitor the health of the forest. Train them and treat them as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Don't look at them in a condescending way. And then provide them access to education, healthcare, sanitation. We can't really expect them to change their ways when they don't have basic needs first. Take care of their basic needs, and then we can talk to them about other stuff.
Sure. So, but is that exactly what's happening? So I would imagine that you worked with some Orang Asli communities as well with your conservation work. Is that the kind of relationship that that you all currently have?
It's a very complex relationship at the moment, and I think it has to be. I think that this is not black or white, and then it would be a mistake to oversimplify things. So in our team, you know, I work with MIM, the Management Ecology of Malaysian Elephants. We have four members that are from the Temiar community. So then they are part of the team, and you know, it's who we are. I mean, I'm from somewhere else. They are from there, and we have people from Kuala Lumpur. So then we work with them, and they are a big part of what we do and who we are. Dealing with, in this case, human-elephant conflict and the Orang Asli community is very sensitive. Mm-hmm. The more experience I have, the more I'm careful, because I realize that I don't know how to do this thing very well. And the more I'm keen on working with people with more experience on the social aspect of things, I'm an ecologist. I know better about elephant poo than I know about other things. So then I should not pretend to know everything. And I think that the community engagement, these kind of conversations, there are many values, many cultural elements that you cannot just jump in and get it right. So then I'm very keen on working with people who can bring more experience here. So we're going very slow and trying to create positive interaction with these communities.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. So if I was then a person listening to the show, and I've heard the both of you talk about the various things I should know, what would you recommend be some of the most important things that I take away to start my conservationist, environmentalist education?
So I can only say what worked for me. And what worked for me really, it became an intrinsic motivation. And I think that is the strongest motivation it's not to do conservation work, but to lead a conservationist lifestyle. Yeah, intrinsic motivation. It's not, I want to follow some kind of policy, or I want to follow some kind of law, or I want to follow some kind of religion. No, I am part of the earth. I need to take care of the earth. That's my obligation. I need to take care of this, or else it will just be my own downfall. So to do that, I need to take a step back, slow down a bit. Don't get distracted by all the frills of modern life. Yeah, fine, okay, be distracted. But once in a while, step back, breathe. Just slow down. And yeah, breathe. Experience that connectedness with everything, with nature, with life around you. Experience it. I think once people experience that for a bit, just being in nature, breathing, experiencing it, it can open a whole new dimension to the way they look at life. Everything doesn't need to be fast-paced. Everything doesn't need to be about money. Everything doesn't need to be about chase, the latest this, the latest that. It doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, it's breaking free of that growth model.
Hmm. Yeah, I will make two advices at individual level, okay? So what individuals can do. One is spend time in nature. So then go hiking. If you live in Kuala Lumpur, explore the fantastic forest we have within 30 minutes driving or commuting from KL. There are many routes you can just Google and spend time in the forest. It's cool. You know, sweat, get tired, listen, and just immerse into the forest. And the second advice I will give is read. You know, inform yourself, but not in a short-term. Don't look for the short-term reward. Okay, so then get a book. Get good books. You know, when you read a book, just make sure it's a good one that has good reviews, that they have people who are extremely inspiring. You will be inspired, and then you will learn, and you will want to know more. And then you will... It's a process that... for me now, now that I have less time than when I was a child, when I was a teenager, reading is such a luxury. I enjoy so much. I feel privileged every time I have 2 hours to read a book that I like. So read good novels, read good essays from good conservationists, people like E.O. Wilson and people who really can inspire you to want to know more, to want to do better. So these two things are kind of gates to much more.
That's a challenge for you, our foremost book reviewer. How about an environmental book?
Actually,
some of the titles that Ahimsa just suggested.
Yeah, actually, I think we're doing a show about those sorts of books. And I think what you both are saying is absolutely right. I think people, by and large, mean well. And I think maybe want to do good, but have no idea where to start.
Yeah.
And I think if we've done anything on the show, we hope that we've produced at least something that'll give them some sort of catalyst or primer and a direction by which to go.
Just what to do, where to begin, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, gentlemen, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Big pleasure.
That was Dr. Ahimsa Campos Arces, Associate Professor at the University of Nottingham Malaysia Campus, as well as John Mathai, Chief Operating Officer of Rimba Research. If you missed any part of this discussion about educating people on conservation, or if you have friends that are interested in the subject, you can tell them to download the podcast on our BFM app that's available on Apple's App Store and on Google Play. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.